This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. To create your own space, visit squarespace.com and save 10% by using offer code TREK8. And also by TrekFan. It's not just a fan club, it's an adventure. You'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. Don't miss out. Help move us toward the Star Trek future by visiting TrekFan.org. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit Trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me once again, as he is every week, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Now, Matthew, you know, I almost didn't recognize you without your uniform there tonight.
Chris, I'm on a secret mission for a secret organization that I can't really talk about because, well, neither side really likes me, and so I'm a little incognito this evening.
And I know one thing. I know that that organization that you're talking about is not Section 31.
No, it is definitely not Section 31. We do not work with those kind of people. In fact, those are the kind of people that we're trying to get away from.
I understand. And that's why you've taken up residence in this lush jungle that I see here tonight.
That's right. In the wonderful demilitarized zone between Cardassia and the Federation. It's a really fantastic place to live, honestly. I don't know why everyone's not living here. It's why I think everybody's going to be wearing masks in the future. They're just so comfortable.
That makes perfect sense to me. I understand that.
Yeah.
Well, tonight we're going to talk about that lush jungle, the demilitarized zone, and all the lovely people who live there. Those people, of course, are called the Maquis. And, you know, Matthew, the Maquis are really, really interesting because they were set up for Voyager, which we'll talk about in a little more detail as we go along. But DS9 and to some extent TNG were used to set them up. And it's interesting to me because they really, really fit the mold of DS9 much better than they even had the potential to on Voyager.
Well, and I think you're really right, Chris. In fact, I remember, you know, even seeing those episodes on TNG and thinking they were really good episodes of TNG. They're really growing the universe of the Next Generation, kind of expanding those last few seasons, really, getting into some really deeper issues for the Next Generation specifically. And then, of course, moving into Deep Space Nine, they just kind of pick up those stories as well in Maquis Part 1 and 2. You get some fantastic episodes. It really does fit more, especially the serialized type of writing that they did on Deep Space Nine, because you could tell some longer stories and character stories, really, because that's kind of what the Maquis are all about. It's this character battle between the Federation, the Cardassians, and this internal struggle of who the Federation is going to be in and of itself.
Yeah, that's the thing. Not just the fact that they can tell longer stories, but the themes behind the stories, I think, fit very well what was going on at Deep Space Nine. So the Maquis are there. And as a first topic, let's talk about the genesis of the Maquis a little bit. And by that, I don't mean the genesis as in the writers creating them for the shows, but I mean in-universe, the genesis of the Maquis, what brought them about. And it really goes back to the 2350s with the Cardassian War. you know, in the Next Generation, we're seeing the tail end of that war, where the Federation and the Cardassian Union had signed first in 2367, they signed an armistice, which brought an end to the conflict. And it was 3 years later in 2370 when they actually signed the treaty itself. And of course, the treaty is what really threw everything into chaos in the DMZ and is what upset these mostly Federation-born colonists who had been there, who were really upset because they felt that their rights were being violated by the Federation as part of the settlement that was written into this treaty.
Yeah, and I think that this was one of those things that started to shake up that utopian idea for the Federation and what it was. And, you know, it started there in TNG, which I think was some brilliant writing. And then Deep Space Nine really picks that up and ramps that up. That whole idea of you know, who are we going to be? What are we going to do with these people? Can we just kind of bargain away a whole planet, a whole colony's life, to somebody else without them really voting to have that happen?
Right.
And so and the same struggles that governments have had, you know, on Earth for so many years, you know, when something gets annexed and they don't really, that's not really what they want. I love that they really tackle this topic. I thought it was really interesting and it really opened up the world of the 24th century to see what it was like to live there and what happens after a war. How do you create peace? And I think one of the things that also made it really smart is that the peace that was created didn't really make either side necessarily all that happy. And the Federation kind of taking less than it should have in this, you know, and giving up maybe more than it should have just to try and make peace. And it, again, leaving its colonists out to dry. Like, nope, sorry, you got to move. We're giving your planet away. And we'll take the planet for free, you know? I don't know. What do you think about that, Chris? Because that's a big idea.
It's hard to imagine that the Federation would give these planets to the Cardassians when the planets are populated by Federation citizens. It's, you know, the war, it kind of set up the problem in the first place, though, because as part of this conflict between the Cardassians and the Federation, both sides started settling M-class planets in this area of space that were all nearby each other. So it was kind of like a territorial power play that was going on without any thought given to what's going to happen to these people in the future. And it really applies to both sides. What's going to happen to the Federation citizens? What's going to happen to the Cardassian citizens? Even if we draw the border between the two political bodies so that these planets fall within the territory of each side, these people are still going to be living really, really close together. It's almost impossible to think that they will be able to indefinitely live in that area of space peacefully. So the two sides, they set up this problem for themselves. So then they had a really hard time settling it. And when they get to the treaty, and of course the treaty was mostly negotiated by our favorite Bad Admiral Nechayev, who is always a pain in the side of Picard on The Next Generation, and then she's also here to be a pain in the side of Sisko. What do you give up? And how does the Federation Council make that decision to disregard the very, very vocal protests of its own citizens and say, you know what? We don't care. We're going to give these planets to the Cardassians anyway.
It almost makes me think of, you know, when is peace too costly? You know, the Federation kind of really bends over backwards for the Cardassians, and then all they get because of it really is trouble afterwards. And in a lot of ways, I think that the settlers in the Demilitarized Zone have a lot of grievances against the Federation that are very justified. And, you know, you're not protecting us. That's where your citizens, you're just giving away our homes, and what you're doing with the Cardassians isn't actually helping, because, you know, you get nothing but trouble afterwards with the, you know, the Cardassians now working to get more of the demilitarized zone that's supposed to be theirs. I mean, that's just what they do. And so it's very short-sighted, I think, on the side of the Federation to give so much away in good faith when they know that the Cardassians aren't trustworthy at this point.
Right. And it also reminds me, because I live in Japan, you know, it reminds me of this ongoing dispute, which has been going on since World War II, the dispute that we have with Russia over the Kuril Islands, which are the very north of Japan. And we call them the Northern Territories, and they're there. And Russia calls them the Southern Kuril Islands. And ultimately, you know, these people for more than half a century now, so many generations of people have grown up living there. And the people living there are now separate from the territorial dispute between the two countries, right? And so however this gets resolved, and earlier this year, you know, both sides resolved that they're going to find a resolution at last to this. What happens to those people? You know, what are those people? Are those people Japanese? Are those people Russians? Are those people Kurilians? If I want to make up a Star Trek sounding name for them, I don't know. Of course, there are resources at issue as well here, you know, gas resources, but it just shows, you know, when you have a conflict like this, innocent people who all these people are trying to do is to make their lives somewhere. This is where they live. They get caught up in the middle. And that's what happens with the Maquis. You know, these people, they settled there. They farmed the land. They've built a home. They've raised families there. And now sides are coming in and telling them that you can either leave, because that's the option that the Federation gave them, is that you can leave. We'll relocate you. But they don't want to leave because it's their home. And so they get caught in the middle of the conflict.
Yeah, well, and it really reminds me too. I think it harkens back to the U.S. history with, you know, relocation of American Indians to settlements. You know, and saying, "Well, we'll just give you this land. We want this one, but we'll give you this." You know, and or as you know, Picard talks about in Insurrection, the forced relocations of any society in any time period that's happened over, you know, a millennia. Just, this is what happens when people argue over space, any kind of space.
Because on TNG and Journey's End, that's exactly what we have. We have these Native American colonists on Dorvan 5 who refuse to leave, and the Cardassians are demanding that they leave, and then Picard has to go and get involved in that. And of course, that helps to set up the whole character of Chakotay for Voyager, and the idea that there are Native American tribes who were first forced out by the European colonization of North America. And then later, as we see on Voyager, these tribes kind of retreat into little pockets in Mexico and elsewhere in, I guess, Central America, to get away from the technology of the Federation. And then some of them have left, and they've gone and they've resettled other worlds, like Dorvan 5 here in Journey's End on TNG. So it's you know, I mean, that's something they actually did play into in setting up the Maquis.
Which I think is really interesting, that unfortunately Native Americans cannot catch a break even in the 24th century.
They really can't. They cannot catch a break. they settle their own planet, so there's no one to bother them, right? But no. Here come the Cardassians. Here comes the Greater Federation. You just can't. Well, what could you do? Even space is not big enough.
It's vast and infinite. We're still going to argue over it.
Oh, goodness. We really are. Okay, so I just mentioned Chakotay. So let's transition to Made for Voyager, because this is why, as I mentioned in the introduction, the Maquis were created in the first place. And, you know, Jerry Taylor said, if you read in the Deep Space Nine Companion, again, not the Voyager Companion, but the Deep Space Nine Companion, Jerry Taylor talks about how we knew that we wanted to include a renegade element in Voyager, and that the show would involve a ship housing both Starfleet people and these idealistic freedom fighters that the Federation felt were outlaws. And so to avoid having some burdensome backstory and exposition in Voyager's pilot, we decided we could plant the idea of the Maquis in the shows that were already on the air. And, you know, creatively, I think that was a brilliant idea. It's fantastic. And because the audience was so invested in greater Star Trek at the time, and DS9 was still young as well, it hadn't gotten into the very, very serialized stories that came later, they were able to use this and plant the seeds in The Wounded, in Chain of Command, in Journey's End on TNG, and do this great two-parter in the second season of DS9 called The Maquis to set everything up for Voyager.
Well, and what's so funny, Chris, is that the whole fight that the Maquis have with who they are, their very essence of being, means absolutely nothing when you get to the Delta Quadrant, where that fight doesn't exist.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a bad story point for Voyager, but it's a fantastic story point for TNG and Deep Space Nine, where this territorial fight that creates these quote unquote freedom fighters, these rebels, you know, insurgents, whatever you want to call them, really works. You know, where they have a point of existence. But when you take them away from that all the way to the Delta Quadrant, you're left with characters who don't have anything to live for who they've been. It's very, very strange idea, I think.
It is kind of a flawed concept. And again, this isn't to talk badly about Voyager. It's just that I think that the idea that they had was, well, okay, creatively, it's an interesting thing because it sheds itself off in two different directions. They set it all up for Voyager, but the only thing that they were really going to get out of it in terms of Voyager was an excuse for why Janeway and her crew would have to be pursuing Federation citizens and how they would come together. And then the potential to have conflict on the ship itself in the next television series by having these people who they're from the Federation, but they're not the Roddenberry perfect humans that we're accustomed to. And that's what Michael Piller also talks about in the DS9 Companion. He says that the Maquis were born of a desire to have some people who are quite different from the Starfleet human types we see all the time. And I really appreciate that. But they were already starting to do that on DS9. So they were setting up that for the next series. And then for some reason, they got, you know, a few episodes into that series and they quickly abandoned that whole concept. And everyone had to come together and work together because they were now in a situation where they were lost and they had to get home. But the way that it sheds itself in the other direction is that it presents a fantastic story element for Deep Space Nine. And it plants seeds that DS9 was able to come back to over the course of many seasons. And they were even able to tie in the Maquis to the Dominion War later on.
Well, and yeah, that really works. And I think it works really well, especially on Deep Space Nine, just taking that story element and being able to run with it. And plus, you know, Deep Space Nine is perfectly situated right there by the Badlands, by the Demilitarized Zone, by all of these places. So it gives you a great room to work with all of these story elements. And, you know, what's funny is that, you know, if you wanted different people from the Federation, you know, you could have chosen just to have the caretaker have pulled, like, anyone from the Alpha Quadrant. You know, it doesn't have to be Maquis. Yeah. It could have just been people who don't happen to be Starfleet officers. You know, you could have had a freighter crew or something. And, I mean, it really doesn't have to be that way. You know, I think the only thing there that would have really made it work is if they would have had more tension longer. But anyway, this is a Deep Space Nine show, so
right.
I really appreciated that Deep Space Nine didn't just use those elements like say once, but they actually continued the storyline and had it play itself out all the way to the end. Really cool.
That's the thing, because they could have had just these two episodes, and it would have been interesting, and it does stuff for Sisko's character, And it does stuff for the conflict with the Cardassians, which is so central to a large portion of DS9. They could have just left it at that, and I think we would have all been fine with it as DS9 fans, but they did so much more with it. So creatively, the Maquis are just a very interesting thing for me. Designed to set up another show, and yet the show that planted the seeds is actually the show that ended up benefiting more from the entire concept. Well, let's talk about the actual goals and methods of the Maquis and why they are doing what they're doing in the first place. And no one said it better than Sisko himself when he explained that the problem is Earth. And just that statement by itself on a Star Trek show was groundbreaking, I thought, that the commander of the station, that the person who Starfleet has put there themselves, handpicked him, says Earth is the problem. But he makes the perfect point. He says, on Earth, there is no poverty, no crime, no war. You look out the window at Starfleet headquarters and you see paradise. Well, it's easy to be a saint in paradise, but the Maquis do not live in paradise. Out there in the demilitarized zone, all problems have not been solved yet. There are no saints, just people. Angry, scared, determined people who are going to do whatever it takes to survive, whether it meets with the Federation approval or not. And that really sums up the whole bone that the Maquis have to pick with the Federation, the whole reason that they're disgruntled, the reason why life isn't easy for them. And it also really sums up, I think, the entire message of Deep Space Nine as a series as well, is that while everything may be perfect on Earth, the galaxy isn't Earth. Galaxy is real life. Earth is kind of a paradise in the 24th century.
Well, I think that, Chris, this is one of the things that we have just really talked about on this show, is that Deep Space Nine is real life in the 24th century. Earth, or even sometimes when we watch on the Enterprise D, it's too perfect. It's too utopian. Yeah. Everything just works the way it's supposed to. Everything's beautiful and immaculate. But the rest of the universe, and even just the rest of the Federation, isn't necessarily like that, and it adds that realism and really what we've talked about, I think, over and over again, putting to test the ideals of utopian society and how that really works out. And I think Sisko really says it perfectly, is that, if you don't live in paradise, you don't end up being a saint.
Exactly.
You end up doing things that you might not necessarily want to do or feel like you would be proud of in the end, but you kind of have to.
Exactly. And again, we talk about this all the time on the show here. I think that this makes the point of Star Trek stronger, because instead of just saying the future's perfect and here it is, when Star Trek tries to talk about society and it tries to make us look at ourselves and question things so that we can improve and so that we can get to that more perfect future at some point down the road, we have to be shown that things aren't perfect in order for those arguments to be valid in the first place and for us to be able to make determinations on which direction we should go in. So that this grievance that the Maquis have perfectly fits that need in storytelling, I think. And in terms of what their goals are, just like the Bajorans had a specific goal in their fight against the Cardassians, which was to drive the Cardassians off of Bajor and to reclaim their planet for themselves, the Maquis' goal is to retake their worlds and their land for themselves. And they've come to the realization that the Federation isn't going to help them. The Federation sees them as just pawns in the bigger picture of maintaining peace with Cardassia. So what the Maquis have decided to do is to fight back and to use what I guess for... I'm sure the Maquis don't see themselves as terrorists, but they're using guerrilla warfare, terrorist-type methods to achieve their goal because talking to the Federation Council hasn't worked. And they are preparing to declare their independence from the Federation and to declare themselves as their own state. And that is where things are headed, and that's what we're seeing play out over the course of the Maquis Parts 1 and 2, and of course the events that happen further along in the DS9 storyline.
And I think that that's one of the things that's really interesting, and that I thought was really cool, was the fact that their end goal was really to create a completely new section. You know, like, they wanted it to be, they were going to set up their own government, they were going to make their own group of planets that would have, you know, their own trade routes. I mean, all this stuff. They're wanting to create a whole new form of life and government in this demilitarized zone, in the same way that Texas creates itself as a country from Mexico and sets its own form of government. And, you know, it reminds me of that a lot, that kind of like Wild West spirit. And nope, we're going to be our own country, we're going to do our own thing. And I think that that's something that, you know, again, we just don't see a lot of this in Star Trek and Deep Space Nine, just giving us the ability to kind of dig in deeper and see what, you know, life is like on the other side.
Because why would you want to be your own political body? If you're Federation citizens to begin with, why would you ever want to leave that? And I think that parallels very well to, you know, some of the view that the United States has in a lot of cases, where, you know, I think there are a lot of people who think that everyone in the world wants to be American citizens, because what could possibly be better than that? But the world is much more diverse than that, and carry that over to the Federation here. Yes, the Federation might be wonderful, but it doesn't mean that everyone wants to be a member of the Federation. And that includes people who actually are Federation citizens at the moment. You know, sometimes what they see as the life that they want to lead, the path they want to go down, and the future of their children isn't necessarily what the Federation is doing at the moment.
I think it's interesting too, Chris, that the actions that the Maquis are willing to take to get this. And I thought what was interesting is that really their actions are in response to what the Cardassians do. You know, the Maquis don't ramp it up until the Cardassians do. The Cardassians start supplying Galar-class weapons onto their shuttles, giving, you know, smuggling weapons in to their colonies through the Lesepians, really creating this whole area of space, just making it a war zone, basically. And so the Maquis respond in kind to save their skins. And then their goal at that point becomes to fight back, push back, and get the Cardassians out. Also, too, you know, being upset with Starfleet for not coming in and protecting them, either being Federation citizens. And of course, this is really where that grievance comes from with the Federation, of you've given this away and you've trusted the Cardassians, and they've done what we've always known Cardassians to be, which is be untrustworthy. And so it's just, I think it's just really interesting to watch that happen, and that the Maquis themselves are a response to the Cardassians' actions.
And it does beg the question of whether or not the Federation and Starfleet would have been more willing to help the colonists if they had known that the Cardassians were arming the Cardassian colonists in the DMZ.
Right.
But of course, the Cardassians are using intermediaries like the Lesepians to arm the Cardassian colonists. And so the Maquis really have no choice but to fight back. And then that leads to the first really open act of violence by the Maquis, which is destroying the Cardassian freighter Bachnor at the beginning of the Maquis Part 1. That really sets everything into motion and starts to expose some, at least on a low level, some Starfleet involvement in the Maquis, because we find out, of course, that Hudson, Sisko's old friend Hudson, is involved. Now, Hudson's just a lieutenant commander, so you don't expect that there's necessarily any kind of high up thing going on. But of course, the Cardassians may suspect that there's something high up going on.
And this was something that I loved about the through line of the story was that Sisko, when it comes to the Maquis, keeps having people that he's trusted and that are friends of his, that become friends of his, turn their backs on him. And that it really does create this storyline of a man who holds loyalty as being like the linchpin, the key to who he is. And when somebody breaks that with him, they're done. You know, he's going to go after them. And so I think that just makes for just a really interesting story point as well of it creates a very different Commander Sisko and then, of course, Captain Sisko than what we've seen in, you know, Picard or even Kirk setting that man apart.
Well, I mean, I think that comes to the extreme point when he starts having to deal with Eddington and, you know, when Sisko actually takes the fight to Eddington and takes the fight to the Maquis and actually poisons the atmosphere of Solosos 3, which is something you can't imagine that, you know, any Starfleet officer, much less a captain, would ever do. And not only does he poison the atmosphere by dumping this trilithium resin into the atmosphere so humans can't live there for the next 50 years, which is, of course, is a great analogy to, you know, nuclear fallout here on Earth using a weapon like that. But then he tells Eddington, I'm going to do this to all the other Maquis planets as well. And it's, you don't F with the Sisko is basically what we get to here.
Do not frack with the Sisko.
Exactly. So it did change him a lot. And then the fact that Cassidy ends up being involved with the Maquis, I mean, that has to kill Sisko. But it also shows that Sisko is not, he's not turned into just a cardboard character where if you let him down, he's going to turn his back on you. Because, of course, he's hurt by what happens with Cassidy. But he ends up marrying her too. You know, she does her year of time. She comes back to the station. He opens his arms back up to her again. And, you know, it built a lot of character for Sisko.
Well, and it's, I think that what really makes that interesting is that at the end, you know, when Eddington dies and Sisko is left to ponder all that's happened, I feel like his opinion on Eddington has even changed by the end of Blaze of Glory. It's a very well-rounded story because the whole time, you know, Sisko, especially with Eddington, has been very much about this kind of maniacal revenge almost. And he especially loves when he finally, you know, captures him and puts him in prison and that righteousness that Ben Sisko has. But by the end of that episode, I feel like he's seeing things completely differently. And it makes, again, for some really good storytelling here.
Definitely. And, you know, other things that happened with the Maquis, part of the Maquis storyline gives us one of those Let's Torture O'Brien episodes that happens so often.
Exactly, yes.
In Deep Space Nine, where he gets put on trial in tribunal. Of course, the Maquis and the Cardassians trying to set him up to make it look like Starfleet is more involved in smuggling these weapons.
Chris, you know, we have to talk about, I think, that Thomas Riker, you know, steals the Defiant, and which leads into, you know, going into the Rias system where he's, you know, been told about this great big military buildup that leads us into, you know, the Cardassians and the Tal Shiar being led into a trap. It's a trap! Which I always wanted Tane to say in that episode.
He really should have.
It's a trap! All of these storylines that for the Maquis really lead into bigger storylines in Deep Space Nine. And, you know, so if you watch through the entire series, you know, back to back, you really see how they use this storyline to their benefit. You know, they get told, hey, you're going to put these people in your show. okay, well, we're also going to make them work for our show, and we're going to make them work really well. So I just always appreciate that the writers really do that.
Yeah, and they definitely did a great job of that. So let's move into some of the key members of the Maquis. We've talked about a few of them. Of course, Thomas Riker, that was a great job of tying that in because, you know, Second Chances on TNG could have just been a one-off fun right. little episode where William Riker gets duplicated. Thomas Riker leaves the ship and we never hear from him again. You know, he'll be kind of like Jeremy Astor, but...
Exactly.
But they pick it up.
He's part of Worf's family, but we never hear from him again.
But they pick it up here, and they do such a great job of bringing... Like, how are you going to bring Jonathan Frakes on DS9 and make it work and not make it seem like a gimmick to have him on there?
Right.
Because it was a total trap of being a gimmick. But by making it Thomas Riker and making him part of the Maquis... and making him attempt to carry out an action that would have great repercussions for the show itself if he had been successful, makes it not a gimmick, but makes it fit in perfectly with the storyline that they've been building.
And having him be on there, they really were able to give him some great character growth, too, as a character, in the sense that he's realized... how hard it is to come back from life when you've been gone for so long and how behind he is. And he finds something new and something worth really fighting for and living for to differentiate himself between Commander Riker, William Riker. And I think it added just a great story point for him. It was really well done in that sense. So, and just, you know, Frakes going up against Nana Visitor, in that episode was fantastic. I think they just had a lot of fun. So, it turned out to be an episode that, like you said, it could have been terrible. Oh, we're just going to throw, you know, Frakes in and, everybody will watch because it's Frakes. But no, they actually really make this work, I think.
It would have turned out even better if instead of it being Thomas Riker and Major Kira, if it had been Thomas Riker and Nana Visitor as the intendant.
Oh. non-canon novel needs to be written on that.
Imagine that story. There's got to be some fanfic out there somewhere about that. And if there's not...
We've just given people ideas, Chris. That, or it could be a...
People, engage your pencils.
You know, it could just be a mirror universe story where Thomas Riker and the intendant are, you know... intimate.
I'm pretty sure there's got to be a story about that somewhere. So that was great. Thomas Riker on DS9 as a Maquis. Other people we know, of course, Ro Laren got involved with the Maquis. Cassidy being involved with the Maquis was a great story element, as we just discussed. I like when Jake in Explorers actually suggests to his dad that maybe I've joined the Maquis.
Right.
You know, that had to just be a jab in Ben's side right there. That was great. Of course, the greatest Maquis on DS9 and probably the greatest Maquis character, I think you'll agree with me, has to be Michael Eddington, who we just discussed at length, so we won't discuss him further here. But he's probably the greatest member of the Maquis. But, you know, other interesting members, we talk about how Voyager didn't really do much with the Maquis. Of course, Chakotay was the leader of a Maquis cell. Tom Paris got involved in the Maquis. And that's the other thing. B'Elanna as well. And that's the other thing, that while the Maquis primarily was a dissident group for people who felt that their livelihood was being threatened and their rights were being ignored by the Federation, it was also a place where outcasts could come. You know, people who felt like they didn't fit in with the Federation anymore. They didn't fit into Starfleet. Maybe they had been in trouble with Starfleet. It was a place where they could go and kind of seek refuge. And we see that with Tom. We see that with B'Elanna. We even see that with Thomas Riker. But it also is a place where people who just want to kill people
right.
can go. People who are kind of like mentally deranged. And we see that again. You know, when we see any group here on Earth that takes up arms to fight for what it believes in, and maybe has a very specific goal, a goal that we might not agree with their methods, just like we don't agree with the methods of the Maquis, but we can see where they have some specific goal that they're fighting for that, yeah, okay, we can justify that this group of people has been wronged, and it's kind of human nature that you're going to fight for your own livelihood. We can see that. Those groups here on Earth as well, you know, they attract a radical element. We see that today, of course, with terrorism, where people just want to harm other people. And those people aren't even really fighting for the goal of the organization anymore. And we see that with some people who join the Maquis. And when we go over to Voyager, you know, I think Lon Suter is a really good case here, where Suter really has this kind of, I mean, he has an illness. He has a mental illness, but he's just, he's deranged in a way and killing people. And the Maquis is a place where he found a home.
To me, it creates that sense of, if people like that are joining your group, you might want to rethink your group. You know, if that's what's okay to have in your group,
yeah,
I'm not really sure that, that your group is where it needs to be. And so we have a psycho killer as a part of our team, you know, it's fine. It's normal. That's a really good point, Chris. It's something I hadn't really thought about that much until you brought it up.
And it presents another thread that would have been interesting to explore with the Maquis if they had not come to an end, mm-hmm. which is when people like that come into your fold and they start discrediting what you're doing in a way that can't be justified. Of course,
right.
Of course, you know, using the tactics that the Maquis use, it's hard to justify that in the first place. But then when it starts to become random and it starts to become violence for the sake of violence, and then you have to start figuring out, how are you going to deal with this? And, you know, I think it's a thing that happens here today where you have to say, look, we know that some people who claim to represent us are just killing people for the sake of killing people. We don't condone that. To regain credibility for yourself, you have to figure out how to deal with that. You have to figure out how to weed those people out and restore the image, at least, of your organization. And how do you do that? That would have been an interesting story thread to explore further if the opportunity had arisen.
Yeah. You know, Deep Space Nine does get to do that a little bit, let's say, with the conflict they have between someone like Cal Hudson and Sisko. They just don't get to go to that depth of talking about, like, saying having a Lon Suter or something.
Yeah,
you know, committing a lot of murders, and then the Maquis having to deal with the fact that their image is really being tarnished. That would have been a very excellent story to see on a Deep Space Nine episode.
Yeah. Well, they didn't get to do it for one reason, because the Maquis came to an end, and that'll be our last point to talk about today. And in the end, of course, we already talked about how the Maquis had planned to declare their independence from the Federation. They wanted to set up their own little group there, their own way of life. But one reason they never got to do it is that they fell victim to the greater warfare that was engulfing the Alpha Quadrant. And as the whole region of space became embroiled in this conflict between the Federation Alliance and the Dominion, and then the Cardassians, of course, joined the Dominion, things just became bigger than the Maquis. And the Maquis formed an alliance with the Klingons during the Klingon-Cardassian conflict. And they got a lot of help from the Klingons there. They even got 30 Class 4 cloaking devices, which, of course, we find out in Blaze of Glory. And they got other support from the Klingons as well, but it wasn't enough to prevent their ultimate demise, because once Gul Dukat got into position with the Dominion to take out the Maquis, He did it very, very swiftly.
I think it's interesting, Chris, because, you know, a lot of times we even see this on Earth is that when major powers get involved in something, it's the small countries in between that really kind of pay the price. And this small conflict that's been going on gets taken care of very quickly. When major powers get involved, yeah. Finally, you know, and kind of giving you a picture of what would have happened if the Cardassian government had just decided, look, we're not dealing with this anymore. We're coming into the demilitarized zone. We're breaking the treaty. Dukat just creates a whole war that has nothing to do with them, and they get caught in the crossfire.
Well, it doesn't matter if it creates another war because there's already this bigger war going on. So what happened really was that during the Klingon-Cardassian conflict, the Maquis pretty much took over the DMZ. It was pretty much theirs, and they could move around and do whatever they wanted to do. So things were really looking up for them at that point. But then everything fell apart, and, you know, and Dukat, of course, was not happy that the Cardassians had lost their foothold in the DMZ as a result of the war with the Klingons. So yeah, I mean, he got an opportunity. He had the Jem'Hadar at his disposal. 3 days, and the Maquis were gone. It's just bam, 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 no more Maquis. And that was the end of it. And, you know, there were some survivors, of course, and they spread out. But the Maquis, as a political organization, as an insurgent group, really ceased to exist. And there was still so much more potential for that storyline if it had not fallen victim to the grander scheme of DS9.
Well, and I think it just speaks to the fact that Deep Space Nine wasn't afraid to just kind of give you an ending to a storyline and really give you some closure. Well, at the same time, not always making that closure something that you really wanted to see. I don't think anybody as a Star Trek fan thought to themselves, man, I just really want to see the end of the Maquis. I just want them all get wiped out. And that's almost exactly what happens to them. And yet it's just a very well done, well written, and very true to life, I think, storyline. And Deep Space Nine just does a great job of playing that out for us.
Most definitely. Well, Matthew, it has been a lot of fun talking about the Maquis with you today. I mean, it's been kind of heavy, but yeah. I enjoy these kinds of discussions, as you do too, and as I think our listeners do as well, because, you know, that's what Deep Space Nine's about. And that's what we try to make The Orb about. And to that end, we want to send a big thank you to Mark2013CC, who left us an excellent review on the US iTunes store, gave us 5 stars. And what Mark said, Matthew, is he just said tremendous, period. An absolutely fascinating look into the human character through the lens of Star Trek. I can't accurately express my appreciation of the time and effort put into making this a thought-provoking discussion. Great job, and thank you. And so, again, I think that people who do listen to this show are looking for that, you know, somewhat deeper analysis of Deep Space Nine like we had today. And so thank you, Mark, for that review. And if you'd like to leave us a review as well, we would love for you to do that. It only takes about 30 seconds. You know, hop over to iTunes, leave us a star rating and a written review, because it really helps other listeners find the show in iTunes when they search for Deep Space Nine podcasts. And we, of course, love to hear from you as well. Now, Matthew, you know, the Maquis is not the only thing that we've been discussing this week here at Trek FM. I've talked about more topics than I can even remember at this point. So here's a look at what else you may have missed on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
The Dominion War.
I think where we're left is that this helps move forward the character stories that Michael Piller talked about in that second season, that he wanted to do character-driven stories, and this war arc really helps do that.
The Ready Room.
The Cute and the Gray.
Well, there's kind of two sides to his guide to romance, though, because while we do see his futile attempts with Catherine Janeway, there's also the interaction he has with the female Q, which I found be much more interesting.
Decade.
STO Foundry, Alpha Flight.
It's quite light. The main thing is you get to fly around, test your flying skills, and test your ability to withstand combat.
I think we failed in that sort of
thing. But let's just ignore that.
To the journey!
Life on Voyager.
Well, I'm just saying there was a certain, you know, there was a time period when the Doctor was you know, like a Ken doll. So that's all I'm saying.
I would not be a Ken doll. Let's put it that way.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
A stir of echoes.
And it's almost like, in a lot of ways, it's kind of like the way Unbreakable is structured, where he completes his arc and there's still this thing left over.
Warp 5.
Inside Phlox's sickbay.
Once Porthos had been immersed in that broth, it almost became like a master stock.
Trek News and Views.
Trip Tucker.
Some of those people are going to be like Trip. Some of those people are going to be completely driven by and influenced by that childlike sense of, I just want to see what's out there.
Literary Treks.
Star Trek reference books.
Now, Philip, do you have these spread out? So, like in your workshop, are you trying to actually recreate a life-size replica of the Enterprise-D? And what do your neighbors think about that?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all those shows. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week. Some days we even have two shows for you. A wide range of viewpoints, a wide range of personalities. You'll find them everywhere you find podcasts, in iTunes, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, on Windows Phone, Zoom, Xbox. You can stream from the website. You can download files from the website. Check it all out. Go to trek.fm/pd for podcast directory, and you'll get all the links there. And if you'd like to contact us in other forms, you can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show. Choose the orb. That will come to Matthew and me by email. If you'd like to send us a voicemail, you can do that. Look at any page on the website. Along the right-hand side, you'll see a tab that says send voicemail. If you click that, a box will appear. You can record a voicemail using your webcam's microphone and upload it to us as an MP3 file. And if you'd like to talk to other listeners, you can do that over at trek.fm/forums, where you'll find a section for the orb and one for DS9. And as far as social media goes, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And we're always on Twitter, tweeting away about Star Trek under username TrekFM. Now, Matthew, what if people would like to find you personally, share their thoughts with you? Where should they go?
Well, if you'd like to find me, I am on Twitter at MattRushing02, so you can check me out there, as well as we do another show together, Chris, Literary Treks, where we talk about books and comics and reference books and all those things that go along with Trek and the literary universe, obviously. And so you can check us out there. And then I do have my own personal blog where I just talk about all sorts of different things like movies and other books that aren't necessarily Star Trek related, just things that are on my mind. That is at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. And so you can check me out there. But Chris, you know, when you're not hiding out from Cardassians and the Federation trying to get away in your Maquis sport vessel, where can we find you?
Well, you can usually find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much anywhere on social media under that same username. And Matthew, like you, I have my own website where I talk about non-Star Trek stuff, believe it or not. And that's at cbrianjones.com. So you can check me out there as well. And elsewhere on the network, besides Literary Treks, you'll find me every Friday with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where we talk about Enterprise. Very much the same way we talk about Deep Space Nine here. It's a little bit more lighthearted than the orb is, of course, being Enterprise. But we have a great time talking there. And you'll find me on the Ready Room every Tuesday, sometimes with Matthew, sometimes with other hosts from around the Trek.fm network and special guests from the world of Star Trek. And we talk about Deep Space Nine, of course. We also talk about all the live action Star Trek series and the movies. So go check that out at trek.fm/trr. And you'll really enjoy that show, I'm sure. And also, Matthew, before we let everyone go, we'd like to ask you to please support our sponsors for this week's show. Your support of our sponsors is very important to making it possible for us to bring the Orb and all the other programming on Trek.fm to you every week. First, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, a website, a portfolio, an online store, really anything that you can imagine. You know, Trek.fm is built on Squarespace. I've been a Squarespace user for 6 years. My personal site's there, my company site's there. I even build sites for clients on the Squarespace platform because the tools are so amazing and it makes my job so easy. I'd love for you to try it for yourself. You know, go there, create your own space today. You can try it free for 14 days. There's no credit card required. Just enter your name and an email address, and in a matter of minutes, you'll be building your own beautiful website. And when you decide to sign up, and I know you're going to, you can use our offer code TREK8 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And if you choose the annual plan, you'll get a free custom domain registration as well. So go try it out, squarespace.com, use offer code TREK8, and we thank Squarespace for their support of The Orb and Trek FM, and we thank you for supporting Squarespace. Also, please visit TrekFan.org. Now, TrekFan is an amazing chance for you to get together with other Star Trek fans to do more than just talk about Star Trek. Now, I love to talk about Star Trek, and Matthew, I think you like to talk about Star Trek too. I have just a little inkling that that's the case. Am I right?
I do, Chris. I really do.
You really do. And and you like to, you know, hang out with the Maquis and do all this stuff too. But, you know, we're never going to get to do that stuff in the future if we just sit here and talk. What you can do at TrekFan.org is get together and solve puzzles and complete real life mission objectives. Basically, you're going to be building things to move us towards that Star Trek future, using your love of Star Trek to make the world better down the road. So go check it out. It's a great way to challenge your intellect as well. Support us, support TrekFan by going to TrekFan.org. Solve that first puzzle. Take the next step on your adventure, and we thank TrekFan for their support of The Orb. And lastly, we have one more thing for you. If you would like to personally get involved and support Trek FM, you can do that as well. Go to trek.fm/donate. We have 8 alien-themed badges for you over there, and they're perfect for your shirt, for your bag, for your civilian Maquis clothing, perfect for running around in the jungle. Now, Matthew, I don't think we have any Maquis artwork available yet, but you know, maybe down the road, a Maquis emblem would be the perfect thing for one of these buttons.
Yeah, like a nice We Love Eddington button or, you know, something like that. Eddington for president.
Oh, no. Eddington for president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cisco poisoned my planet's atmosphere and all I got was this lousy button.
Exactly.
I don't know if that's going to be very popular. I don't know about that, but we'll see what we can come up with. Something tasteful in the future. So you can get these. They're 44 millimeters in size. They're a nice size, and they have original illustration by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. And also now we have A5 art prints, which give a really beautiful, like a waist-up view of these aliens. You can see the whole uniform design, the faces. They're really gorgeous, and you can get those as well. You can mix and match buttons and art prints. You can choose which ones you like to have. There are different levels of donation, and your contributions help us cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring The Orb and the rest of our programming to you every week. So check that out. We really appreciate your support over at trek.fm/donate.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.